name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And by God's grace, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since August 15th of 2007. And I need to say that by God's grace, because sometimes I might try to think that I have something to do with that. But, it's only an unmerited gift from God that I'm standing here sober, man. Even if I have one day, 2 days, 7 years, it doesn't matter. It's only by God's grace that I'm standing here. Actually, I don't have a home group right now. I was a member of the Problem Solve group the last time I spoke here. We had a little problem that we couldn't solve. So then we became the Love and Service group of Queens, New York. There weren't too many loving members in the group. I mean, it's been too much service. So that didn't last very long. So, but anyhow, having a home group is one of the most important relationships in my life. So actually, me and the sponsee, we've been getting together weekly since early January, and we're currently looking for a facility, and we actually need a name for the group. So I do have a home group, we just don't have a name for it right now, so we're absolutely open to suggestions. If anybody has any, please see us after the meeting. I think I'm going to repeat what Mildred said last year. This is my favorite group in Alcoholics Anonymous. The spirit here is just absolutely amazing. I don't feel it anywhere else. Beside my last home group, when we were rocking, you know, there was that spirit there, and I haven't felt there anywhere else. So, some of my favorite people in AA sitting in this room tonight, and, you know, I got to thank them, because my first trip here 4 years ago, I was in a phase in Alcoholics Anonymous where I had such an amazing spiritual experience. It just blew me away, man, and my total perception on life had changed. I was looking at the world from a new pair of glasses. I was happy, joyous, and free. But, I mean, this illness, this disease that we suffer from could be so tricky, man. The ego is so tricky. And what started to happen to me is somebody whose life was saved by Alcoholics Anonymous started to catch resentments with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. People who weren't doing it the way I was doing it. And I became very mechanical here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my heart was becoming cold, and I wasn't sharing a message of love, and I wasn't being very effective. And as I was going through it, I actually visited you guys here, and I heard a convention, I believe it was in Buffalo. There was a couple of members from the Three Legacies group that have spoken. And then later on that evening, we came here, and I met some fabulous group members, and it's actually been a turning point in my sobriety, so I need to thank all of you for that here in the Love and Service group, and the hospitality has been amazing. Every time I come here, I am absolutely spoiled. Tremendously spoiled. Really. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm here tonight to share, and I might freak somebody out, some newcomers, a love story. And the love story begins with alcohol, but it ends as a love story with God. You know, that's my experience. When I was a little kid growing up in Brooklyn, New York, I had the earmarks of a spiritual illness at a young age. I remember always being filled with fear. I don't have a whole lot of memories from childhood, but I do remember being filled with fear. I do remember at a young age being brought to school for years. My mother would bring me to school and drop me off, and I would cry for mommy. Yeah, and Italian guys from Brooklyn cry for mommy. They don't grow mustaches to look like mommy, but we do grow mustaches. And why was I crying? Because I was so filled with fear, consumed with fear, and I couldn't imagine what it was going to be like walking into class and meeting new students and trying to make new friends. It was just like torment, emotional and mental torment for somebody like me. And I remember being in dark places, even as a young kid, you know, even thinking about committing suicide at a young age. I got involved in sports at a young age. I was a pretty good athlete, and you know, that's something that did it for me. It kept me out of my head, you know. My father coached my baseball teams, and, you know, he was very involved in my hockey teams. And, you know, for years I used to love being out in the streets and playing sports, man. My mother would have to come out at, like, midnight and come get me, drag me into the house, because I always wanted to be out playing ball, you know. Because it relieved whatever was going on in my head, you know. And just like a number of other things in my life that only lasted for, you know, a few years. It couldn't really do the trick for me. You know, because what started to happen is I hit this age where I no longer felt comfortable playing on the baseball team because now the kids are starting to play better than me. I no longer felt playing on the hockey team because the kids were bigger than me and stronger than me. I didn't feel comfortable and I was filled with fear. You know, and I remember even at that age, like 12 years old, sitting in the dugout by myself. You know, I went from the kid who was like the center of attention in the dugout, was one of the best players on the team. Now I'm sitting in the corner because I'm so afraid. And the same thing on my hockey team. Remember the older kids skating up to me, sitting by myself, saying, come on, come join the rest of us, man. You know, and I just couldn't do it because I was just so afraid of it. So the reason why I share, because this has a lot to do with the feeling produced by alcohol. Because while I'm going through all that fear, even at that young age, this world doesn't make much sense to me. It's a tough place to live. What's the sense of living in a world like this if it's so painful and I'm always in my head? You know, it's like torment, you know? But even at the age of 12, 13 years old, I don't remember my first drink, but I do remember the feeling produced by alcohol almost every single time that I drank from that young age. You know, at that young age, standing on the street corner in Brooklyn with a 40 ounce of St. Ives or a 40 ounce of Old English, we thought we were like little gangsters, you know? We would pass around that 40 ounce, and I'd get halfway through that thing, and it was just like, all the fear was gone, man. You know, it was like being in my car with blasted heavy metal music, and all of a sudden somebody just hit the mute button, and just, you know, and life made sense to me. And I got that feeling pretty much, even towards the end of my drinking, life made sense to me. I don't believe that reaction to alcohol happens for many people that are not alcoholic. I don't know if that's anybody who's not alcoholic. My mother and father, they drink. They can go to a bar, have a glass of wine or a beer. They can have a glass of wine at dinner. And their reaction isn't, oh my God, life makes sense to me now. Let's drink some more. You know, their reaction to alcohol is, I've had one or two. I'm starting to feel a little bit different. I might have got a little social lubricant. I'm feeling all right, and I'm going to stop right then and there. And my sister has a legitimate, true allergy to alcohol. If she drinks alcohol, she breaks out in rashes, you know? So me and my family members have a totally different reaction to alcohol. But here's the deal. I don't know if I was an alcoholic at the age of 12, 13 years old. For me, this illness is so tricky. It doesn't allow me to see exactly when it happens. It doesn't announce itself and say, hey, Mike, on your 14th birthday, you're going to turn into an alcoholic. You should really watch out for it. You know, this thing disguises itself in so many ways. And for me, one of the most clever ways it disguises itself is say, you're just an addict. Let's not look at your alcoholism. You're only an addict. You know what I mean? So, that being said, I had a ball drinking. I really did. I'd be a liar if I said the first time I drank, I ended up in the psych ward. You know, the first time I drank, I ended up in rehab or a hospital. That didn't happen for years. You know, I loved the feeling produced by alcohol, and I wasn't throwing up on my shoes. And, you know, I was just in a fun stage of alcohol for years. You know? But in hindsight, I remember having some sort of reaction to alcohol that not everybody was having. I remember going to teen clubs at the age of 14 years old. And, you know, while all the kids were probably staying home and studying for school or whatever, I was going to the liquor store and I was buying bottles of Brass Monkey. We would down that thing and there's my reaction. And we'd go to the teen club and we'd have another bottle, a couple of 40 ounces, passing it around the car. And you know, we get to the teen club and we're dancing, man. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I feel like Ronnie Romance. My shirt's coming off. And I feel like, man, you know, life makes sense, you know? But now I'm like 2 hours into the club and I'm 14 years old and I'm in a teen club. They don't serve booze. And so what happens? I start to get real uncomfortable. The effect from alcohol starts to wear off for me. And I'm looking around at everybody else having a good time, and I'm like, I'm not enjoying myself. I need to leave. Let's blow this joint. I got to get out of here. You know, let's get back to the neighborhood and go to the corner grocery store and sit on milkshakes and drink 40 ounces. You know, I need that stuff, man. I don't know about you, but I cannot party without it, you know. So that's the reaction that I started to have even at a young age, man. And like I said, I've gone through different stages of of drinking, and my sponsor used to describe it wonderfully, a lot better than I can. He said there was the fun stage, and then there was the fun problem stage, and then there was just the problem stage. And if I fast forward this thing, you know, I had so many good reasons not to drink till then. I had a, you know, promising future ahead of me. I was, believe it or not, I was an A student. I had an academic scholarship, full ride to the high school. I had an academic scholarship to St. John's University. Bright, promising future ahead of me. My father had high hopes for me. He used to tell me, you know, I never worry about you. I worry about your brother, but I never worry about you. You're going to do great in life, kid. You know, involved in sports and this bright, promising future ahead of me. I mean, that alone is a reason not to get involved in the things that I was getting involved in. But the alcoholism ripped that hope for me that I had, the hope for my family members, ripped it right away from me. Because I remember around the age of 19 years old and this bright, promising future ahead of me, and I woke up one day and I sat on the couch with my father. I said, "Dad, I'm leaving college." And he looked at me and he said, "You're absolutely nuts." And I could see the pain in his face. And in my head, I'm thinking, I am just so thrilled with alcohol, and I am so thrilled with this lifestyle that I'm living, that I just want to quit college, and I just want to make money, make cash, hustle on the street, and just spend all my money on drinking and getting loaded. That's all I wanted to do. That's what all was on my mind. Again, I'm sitting in college, that same scared little kid that I was at 5 years old or 6 years old when my mother was dropping me off at school. Now I'm 19 years old, and I'm feeling the same exact way in a college class, and I can't deal with it. You know, I need the solution to what's going on in my head, so let me drop out and make money and pay for that solution, you know? And this thing took a wicked turn on me, man. Really, really did. You know, I didn't learn until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous what was really going on with me. And here's what my reaction to alcohol started to look like. You know, I go away to a trip to Vegas with my friends, and we go down to a bachelor party, and there's 30 of us there, right? And we all go out to dinner at the same exact time, we all sit at the same dinner table, we all order a drink, right? And there we are, we all start to loosen up. We all have a reaction. I'm having a reaction that I can live life at last, you know what I'm saying? So we leave that dinner, and we go out to the club, and they're having drinks with me. Right? Now it's like 2 in the morning, some of them are slowing down, and we start to lose a few others, right? I'm still drinking. 4 o'clock in the morning rolls around, and shut the place down, I'm still drinking. Now I gotta find the after hours place. Now we're down to like 2 or 3 guys, and we find the after hours place. Everybody else, 27 of the guys have gone home, right? So now we're in this after hours joint, and then we leave there, and now I finally lose the last 2 guys, right? And now I go find the place that, you know, you find the low bottoms at, right? You know, the sun is coming up, and you got to find a taxi driver that knows a low bottom spot for me. And you even got to pay him a few bucks to get there, you know what I'm saying? So I get there, I'm in this hole in the wall, my friends are long gone, right? And I'm not even enjoying myself anymore. But I learned the Alcoholics Anonymous, what that was that I was suffering from. I was suffering from a craving beyond my mental control. I would have loved to have gone back to the hotel room with those guys, you know? But I leave that place and I go back to the casino, and I'm sitting there at 9 o'clock in the morning drinking vodka with Red Bulls, and I'm sitting at a Joker poker machine and just hitting that button and throwing my money in there, and I am not having fun at all. I am not enjoying myself. But again, I'm drinking because I have a craving beyond my mental control. The 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock rolls around, and my friends are looking for me, saying, "Mike, we need to get out of here. Our flight's in a couple of hours." And they drag me away from the bar, and they bring me to the airport, and I'm drinking in the airport. It's 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's almost 24 hours later, and I'm still drinking, and I'm not having fun in the airport. You know, and I get on a plane, and there I am, I'm out of booze, and I pass out on some poor girl next to me, and you know, the flight attendant looks at my friends, and I got a walking wire around my neck and says, "Does that guy need medical attention?" You know, because there I am, I'm just a disheveled mess. But again, I wasn't having fun. I'm drinking beyond, you know, because I'm craving beyond my mental control. And I never knew what that was. Why was it when I went into the bar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday with my friends who came home from work, And we went into that bar, and we had the same amount of drinks within an hour. And an hour later, they're okay to pull away from the bar and go home. And I'm looking at them and saying, you guys are crazy. How the heck do you do that? And if I pull away from that bar, there's definitely something going on with me. You know, I just don't have that cutoff switch. It's like it wakes this beast up inside of me, and I cannot calm the beast. And all I can do is just get more and more and more and more. You know, and I respect out there in the fifth tradition here, but here's the phenomenon of craving to show up for me too. I'll go into that bar and I say, I'm only going to have a few, and I have a few, and my leg is shaking 10 minutes later, and I'm on the phone with the guy. That's how the phenomenon of craving shows up for me as well. And that's my truth. And if the phenomenon of craving was the only thing that I suffered from, it wouldn't be so scary for somebody like me, because I would just put the drink down and never pick it up again. But why is it, after countless experiences where I'm ending up in these horrific situations, because I pick up a drink and I cannot guarantee you what's going to happen. But towards the end, 9 out of 10 times, it's going to be pretty damn ugly. You know? My mind will tell me over and over and over again, it's going to be that 1 out of 10 times where you end up in a Copacabana in the VIP section. You know what I'm saying? And my mind will constantly bring me back to the same bar over and over again that I went to for years. And I said, this week there's going to be a hot girl in there, or a girl that I'm going to be attracted to. And it was the same old men that I was looking at for the past years. And there was never an attractive girl that I was attracted to in that bar. It sounds funny, but that's what my mind would do to me over and over and over and over again. And like I said, I couldn't guarantee you what was going to happen. And my family knew what was going on. My poor old man, he would come to the bar. First, he would hide across the street. And the guy's like, what is that guy, a ninja or something? He's hiding on walls and houses. It's funny, but imagine, I can't imagine being a parent today having to do that for my son. And he would sit down with me at the bar and wouldn't even drink. Because he felt that somehow, some way, he could control his son's drinking. Again, I can't guarantee you what's going to happen. And 9 out of 10 times, it's ugly. You know, I'm going to end up in a hotel room doing crazy, absurd things. I'm going to end up in somebody's basement, lonely, by myself. I'm going to end up in my apartment, by myself. I'm going to end up sitting in the car all night long, by myself, doing crazy, absurd things that I would not share in a meeting here tonight, you know? And going back to it over and over again. And I'd go on these binges, and I would swear, Sunday, Monday morning, I would swear from the bottom of my heart, because I would hit these deep, dark, mental depressions. I mean, I would literally, I totally identified with Bill W. when he would fear jumping out his window, so he would drag his mattress to the lower floor. I know that feeling. When I wake up in the morning, or I haven't slept for days, and my body is just in torment. I'm in the physical pain, I'm in mental darkness, and to me, I just want to open my front door and run into oncoming traffic and get hit by a car and end up. And I sit there and I'm fantasizing about suicide. I just want to end it all. You know, and I would sit there and I'd put a 38 in my mouth and I would just pray that I want to pull the trigger, I want to do what I want to do, it. And I would think of my old man, I would think of my mother, and I'd say, I can't do it. You know, but I can't live like this no more. But this time I mean business. I'm really, really going to try it this time. You know, and I'd go out with high hopes, and I'd come up with all these great plans. I'm going to go spend some time at my sister's house in the Hamptons. I'm going to go hang out with my girlfriend and try to have a good time with her. You know, I'm going to go out to dinner on weekends with my family members. I'm not going to hang out in that corner bar anymore. And I'd have these great plans, and then, you know, Monday, I'm on it, man. It's not happening. Tuesday, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. Wednesday, I'm on the track. I'm running. I got a new pair of sneakers. I'm tanning. I got a fresh haircut. And I mean it. I mean business. I'm doing great. You know what I'm saying? And there's no way this thing is going to beat me. Friday comes around. You know, I leave work. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm getting the itch. I'm missing something. Well, here's alcoholism playing a trick on me. You're missing something. And then what do? I have an obsession beyond my mental control, beyond my control. I cannot wish it away. There's nothing I can do. I got a 40,000 thoughts in a way, maybe 20,000 times I'm thinking about sex during the day, and maybe one time I'm thinking about alcohol, and it pushes aside all other thoughts. And there I am, boom, I'm at the corner bar, and I'm doing the same thing that I swore that I was never, ever, ever going to do again. You know, and I'm the guy that ends up in the hospital because I'm in my house drinking alone, and I get really lonely, and I take handfuls of pills because I just want to end it all. You know, and I end up in the hospital, and I'm on my deathbed, and you know, the priest comes in to see me, and my family members there crying hysterically. I've never seen my old man cry before, except for me, three times in my life. And that was one of the times he was standing over my hospital bed and seeing his son in horrific condition. You know what I mean? How hard has it got to be for a father to look at his son dying of alcoholism, you know, dying from everything else he's doing, when he has such high hopes for me? You know, and I remember that particular day when I was sitting in the hospital on 4th of July weekend, and I'm looking at my family, and I swear I'm never going to put them through this again. And that was one of the most horrific experiences I had in my life. You know, I was on suicide watch, and I remember my body clamping up on me. I don't know the medical term for it, and I have yet to find anybody who knows the medical term for it. My toes curled, my fingers curled, my jaw locked, I couldn't talk, and it was just so physically painful. And I never ever wanted to experience that again. My family members wanted to take me out that night to celebrate my recovery because they knew I had business at the time. You know, how could he ever drink? How could he ever get loaded again after that experience? It's impossible, right? They don't know. They don't have the mind of an alcoholic, right? So I leave that hospital with high hopes. I'm on my way to celebrate my recovery with a family dinner, and I make a pit stop. I'm doing the same exact thing that I said half an hour ago that I was never, ever, ever going to do again. And my brother see me at 5 o'clock in the morning with strange people coming in and out of my house, and he took one good look at me, and he said, "Oh my God, are you nuts?" And I remember looking him in his eyes, and I couldn't talk, and I just said in my head, like, "I'm nuts, there's something wrong with me. And I'm never, ever, ever going to be able to stop doing this. I'm going to live like this for the rest of my life unless I kill myself." You know? And that's what really started to happen to me, is that I started to obsess over suicide. I hit that point in my life where I couldn't picture my life with alcohol, and I couldn't picture my life without it. You know, they talk about it in a book a couple of times. And I was willing to, at times I felt like I was willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. You know, and I would struggle with that constantly. Right, and I suffered a whole lot of pain, and it brought me to a place where I was willing to try something. And I was probably about 23 years old, and I said I'm going to try rehab. You know, I didn't know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. My father occasionally might have mentioned a friend that he had who at one time used to drink, and now he's going to Alcoholics Anonymous. My only experience with an AA meeting was an enactment of it on television. None of my friends were sober. I didn't have contact really with anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. So all I knew was rehab. That's what you see on TV. That's what you see on the internet. Well, that's what I saw. And I didn't have the luxury of somebody coming to my bedside and saying, "Let me take you to Alcoholics Anonymous." I'm very jealous of people who have that experience. So here I am, my old man, you know, the guy I always run to, man. If I'm ever in a jam, he's the one I want to be in a jam. And I go crying to him, "Pop, I need help." And he drives me upstate New York, and, you know, we mean business. I think I'm going to prison. I don't know anything about rehab either. You know, my jewelry is coming off, and I'm like, "Dad," and the first guy looks at me, "Oh, do I punch him in the face? Do I knock him out?" You know, and he's just like shaking his head, you know. Serious. This is what's going on in my mind. I think I'm some sort of tough guy. You know what I mean? And here I go. I walk into his rehab, and this is why the greeting commitment is my absolute favorite commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I walk into this rehab and I'm greeted not by somebody who works at the facility, but somebody who's a resident in the facility who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who had 5 years and who had relapsed, and now he was there standing at the door waiting for me to come in to greet me. And he said, "Hello, my name is Brian W. and I'm an alcoholic and I had 5 years more time in Alcoholics Anonymous." He goes, "I'm counting days now, but I just want to let you know I'm here to help you out because they tell me to do service and that's what I'm doing now." And that guy had less than 30 days and he took me under his wing. And that was my first introduction to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with Brian W. And I'll never forget that guy. And I didn't see him for years after that. And I never forgot his face. I never forgot his name. So here I am, though. I'm in this facility. And on my way there, I think 28 days, I'm going there for 28 days, and I'm good. You know, I learned either how not to drink, how not to get high, and how to drink successfully. And boy, was I in for a rude awakening. You know, they started bringing 12-step meetings in, and I learned about sponsorship, and I learned about AA meetings, and home groups, and you know, working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and power grading myself, and my own conception of God, and I'm like, oh man, I'm a street kid from Brooklyn. We say run harder, find God, and now you tell me this is my only solution, man. And I was scared to death, you know? But I remember that. I'm like, this thing is so tricky. I mean, I'm on my way there, and I'm suffering, man. But the ego reemerges after like a week, you know? And I'm sitting in there, and this guy's in that rehab, and they're saying, I'm here for the third time. They got to go to a special meeting, you know? Because they're there one or two times. And I'm saying to myself, I'm never going to be that guy. How do you leave here and drink again? That's not me. I'm never going to be that guy, you know? Long story short, I ended back in that facility less than 3 months later. You know what I mean? And then another facility less than 3 months after that. So I was a three-time felon within, you know, a few months myself. And so there I was, judging those people, and I was in their seat. You know, and that's why I hate the term winners and losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe there's any losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm the guy that really had a hard time. I stepped that out at rehab, and I got a sponsor, and you know, I started doing a commitment. They told me to be there at 6 o'clock. I showed up at 6:30. They told me to make 90 meetings in 90 days. I told the guys I'll make 4 a week. You know, my sponsor told me to call them every day. I would call them maybe twice a week. You know, but I tell you one thing. It didn't matter who was sponsoring me then. It doesn't matter if the guy with 40 years in this room was sponsoring me then. It doesn't matter if Bill and Bob was sponsoring me then. I wasn't ready, you know. But here's what happened, though. Seed was planted for me because my first sponsor who brought a meeting into that facility, and I called him when I got out of there, I got to see what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for him in his life. This guy was a mess. He used to say, I don't know if I'm alcoholic or addict. I used to shoot vodka in my veins, you know? And so this guy was like, you know, he's bad, man. You know, stay away from that guy. You know, a lot of people used to say, but here he was, and he was an electrician like me. You know, I needed that one thing to identify with. You know, he was Italian, and he was an electrician, you know? And I was like, I can hang with this guy, you know? But that ended up being the first male mature relationship in my entire life, was with my first sponsor. I remember writing letters about, I thought like he was going to be like a therapist, and I'm writing about all my ex-girlfriends. Oh, Vicky, she left me, and you know, I'm trying to get back with her, go to rehab, and she won't answer my phone calls. And I remember just being laughed at a lot, you know? But he took me into his home, and I got to see what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for him. And I got to speak to his wife, and I got to see the condition that he was once in. You know, he was an absolute mess. And there he was a productive member of society. He was a productive member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a good husband, he was a good employer, and he was a good father. And these are all things that I wanted in my life. But what happened is, I wanted those things, but I couldn't pull that off. Because when you have an obsession of the mind that keeps bringing you back to the drink over and over, I can't be successful at anything. And I would see people walking in the park with their dogs, and I'd say, I want to be that person. And I would see them walking with briefcases on the way to work, and I'd say, I want to do that. And I'd see people playing with their kids, and I'd say, I want to have kids. I want to be a productive member of society. I want to show up to work. I don't want to be known as Mikey No Show at work anymore. I don't want to disappear from work 6 months at a time. I don't want to go in and out of hospitals. And I would see these people doing these everyday normal things, and I would sit in my car and I would cry. Why can't I do these things? And here this guy was. He was just in the same shape as me, if not worse, and he was able to do those things by the grace of God. And the seed was planted. So I ended up back in that rehab, like I said, within a couple of months. And I remember the last time I was there, I raised my hand the last day of attendance. I said, for the last time I'm here. And the director looked at me and said, anybody who says that usually ends up back here. And I caught my first resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. But So anyhow, I'm in and out. I'm in and out. I got one day back, and you know, I got 2 weeks, and I got one day back again. And I'll pull 3 months together. I'll get another 3 months together, and I'm in and out. And what starts to happen is that somebody like me thinks that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. You know, I go to detoxes today. I go every once a month, or sometimes more. I do psych ward work. We've done correction work together, me and my network. And I always ask that question. How many people in here believe Alcoholics Anonymous isn't going to work for them? And the hands go flying up. And I'd say like 80% of the people in that room think Alcoholics Anonymous isn't going to work for them. And I share my story with them, and I say I know that what that's like. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't going to work for me. You know, and I believed in God. I started to believe in God. I didn't have a whole great understanding of God. I still don't. I had my own conception of God, which wasn't the God that I was brought up with, and I was embarrassed to say that because I had all these religious tattoos all over me. Again, I was trying to be a gangster. That was one of the things I wanted to be successful at in life, and I failed at that too. The gangsters don't trust alcoholics. So, but here I am. I'm an absolute mess. In and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it doesn't work. And I tell these people, I identify with you. I thought it wasn't going to work for me either. You know, I went even so far to say, you know what, maybe it worked for my sponsor, and it worked for that guy, and it worked for that girl, and even worse for that guy who was homeless on the street one day, eating out of garbage cans, you know, and even the guy who's not as bad, maybe it worked for them, but I'm just so screwed up that not even God can fix me. I'm just that screwed up. You know? And then I don't know what's going on with me. If Alcoholics Anonymous can't fix me, I got to start looking at textbooks, you know, and diagnose myself. What am I suffering from? What am I suffering from? Is it multiple personality disorder? Do I have schizophrenia? You know, what sort of treatment do I need? You know, do I need therapy? Do I need medication? And I try these things. I go for therapy. You know, and I sit and I only last one visit. You know, I go for medication and I abuse the medication. You know, a guy like me is always looking for a door number three. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I was offered door number one, was to drink and go on to the other end, or door number two, to accept spiritual help. But I see that pretty girl over there and I'm saying, that's door number three and I'm going to try that. She's going to fix me. I see that nice car over there and I say, that's door number three, that's going to fix me. You know, see them drugs over there, that medication, that's going to fix me. It's going to do the trick. And it's a bottomless pit. I'll fill this alcohol, try to fill this thing with all the booze, with all the drugs, with all the women, with all the money, with all the pretty nice shiny things in life, and it just can never be filled. And I'm always feeling empty. So I even try to find a facility that has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, that just they just believe you have the right to choose whether or not you're going to drink. And it's a 6-week program, and I start to clear up after 3 weeks, and I'm like, wait a minute, it cost my family $10,000 for them to tell me I have a choice to drink or not? I'm going to leave now. After 3 weeks, I'll save them $5,000. And they got their money back. I saved them $5,000. Go home on Wednesday. Go home on Wednesday, and drunk on Friday. And my father was on vacation. And when he got back, to his surprise, not only did I come home from this treatment facility, but I brought somebody home with me from the treatment facility. So not only am I running romance, I'm rehab Romeo as well, you know? Because she's going to fix me. You know, we were meant to be broken together in that rehab and come home together and start our life together, you know, my father's basement. Oh, man, the insanity. So here it is, August 15, 2007. I'm sitting on my father's stairs. I'm a minute out of work and disappearing for 6 months at a time. Suicide is something I obsess about often. I'm broke. You know, I can't survive without my parents helping me out. I'm constantly getting thrown out of the house. I'm homeless, but staying in people's houses. And my father's allowing me to stay on his bed, and he's looking at me like I'm some piece of crap, and I can't believe my son, look at you, you're an alcoholic, you're a junkie. You know, that would kill me, it would just eat me up. And this one particular day, I mean, I was sitting on the stairs, and And I was going to go in my closet, pull out a 9mm and blow my brains out. And God intervened. It was the darkest moment in my entire life. And it ends up being the absolute best moment in my entire life. Because I suffered so much pain that I had a nervous breakdown, and I believe I was forced into a state of surrender that day. I ended up in the emergency room, and from there into the psychiatric ward. And I was there, and I was fighting my way to get out of that psychiatric ward. It was a divine inspiration for me. It truly had to be. You know, and I had the same temptations I had at that facility. It was, you know, some girl coming on to me there, and divine inspiration, divine help. I was able to stay away, and I said, I got to focus on sobriety. When I get out of this place, I got to call that man that was avoiding to be my sponsor. I'm going to do everything he asked me to do. I'm going to take all the suggestions in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't because I woke up that day and I said, I'm going to be a great guy today, and I'm going to really do Alcoholics Anonymous. I was beaten into that state of reasonableness. Circumstances made me willing. Our book describes it wonderfully. And I stepped out of there, and, you know, my feet were doing what my mouth was saying. You know, I was taking the actions of a surrendered man, and I was getting the results of a surrendered man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I called that man, and we got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was subject to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew what was going on. I knew at that point I was suffering from a spiritual malady, and I knew that the only way I was going to overcome my alcoholism was by having a spiritual experience. I knew it scared the crap out of me. It really, really did. It was like being laid up in a hospital after a serious car accident on my deathbed, because I was dying. I was dying. And a doctor looking at me in my hospital bed and saying, do you believe in miracles and spiritual experiences? Because that's your only hope of survival here. I mean, that's my truth. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm only standing here today as a result of having a spiritual experience, as a result of God's grace. Not because Mike's some sort of great guy. You know? And we got busy, knowing that's what I was suffering from. And again, there was times I wasn't even sure if I was alcoholic because, again, this disease is so tricky. It would say, you're a drug addict. Focus on this thing. You know, I go into detoxes today, and I say, how many alcoholics are here? And like, nobody wants to raise their hands. They believe they're all heroin addicts. And I said, well, if I had a bottle of booze here, and I poured myself a drink, and I poured you a drink, we finished it, and I poured you a drink and myself a drink, and we finished that, and I took the bottle and I locked it up in the medicine cabinet there, how would you feel? I had one guy get up and told me he was just a heroin addict. He said, I'd punch you in the face, man. I don't tell many people they're alcoholic, but I was tempted, you know? But I mean, normal people don't have that reaction to alcohol. You know? I mean, and that's my reaction to alcohol. You rip a bottle away from me after a couple of drinks and you hide from me, man. I'm going to go ballistic. Like, dude, what are you doing here? You know? So anyhow, being convinced that I'm just screwed up, I know I can't even pick up a drink. I know if I pick up a drink, it's just going to be bad. It's going to get ugly. I had to believe in a power greater than myself, which was going to restore me to sanity. I didn't have to. But I really didn't have many options, you know. It was either suicide, the drink, or that, you know. But again, my old sponsor stuck in my mind. What happened to him as a result of the spiritual experience? I seen what was going on in my current sponsor's life. I seen that he was a DJ who DJed in clubs who at one time couldn't even go near a club anymore because the obsession was so bad on him, he would drink, but now he was doing that, a free man. He was able to DJ a club, a free man. And I seen what Alcoholics Anonymous was doing in his life. He also invited me in his home, and I seen what he was doing in other people whose lives. He was really doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the lights were really turned on in their lives. They were walking around with smiles on their faces, something I didn't have very often. They weren't obsessing over booze. They weren't obsessing over the drinking and meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous on a Friday night with 100 alcoholics and getting ripped out by the obsession of going to drink. They were free. And I said, if this God thing is working for them, maybe it'll work for me. And my sponsor said, if you had the perfect best friend, what characteristics would they have? I said, they'd be kind, they would be loving, they would be compassionate. Right? And he kind of tricked me into doing a second step exercise. He said, why don't you use that as your conception of your higher power? And that was so comforting for me. Because again, here I got all these religious tattoos. I don't even understand what they are. I don't know what they mean. You know, and I can't really believe in something. I don't want to force this thing. I want to get sober. I don't want to lie, you know. But I could run with that. And I started to seek that power with the desperation of a drowning man. And I surrendered, I believe, in the third step. And I made a contract with God. I said, God, if you get me out of this, I promise I will dedicate my life to you without helping other alcoholics. I will do whatever you ask me to do. My life is yours. And my luck really started to change from that day on. And by God's grace, again, it was not because I'm some great guy. It's in His grace that I was even able to pick up a pen and write a fourth step. Which was a mind-blowing experience for me, because I walked around for many, many years with a chip on my shoulder, angry at the world, right? And I'm angry because, and these people are happy because ignorance is bliss, and I'm so smart, I'm so intelligent, and I know the deal in this world, and I'm angry because you guys don't know the deal, and of course you don't know the deal, you don't know how to behave the way I need you to behave, so this world would be a perfect place. You're all stupid, you know? Stupid people. And then my whole world was just, my perception of life started to change when doing a fourth step. I no longer started to see this world as if everybody was wrong. I started to see how screwed up Mike really was. That it was me. But at the same time, it was painful, man. I remember writing my fifth step, my fourth step, and calling Ray with 25 years. And Ray said, and I said to Ray, I feel like I'm going to throw up, I'm crying, and it's like there's a knot in my stomach. He goes, means you're doing it right, man. Keep going. In other words, if I didn't feel that, it would have been concerning for me. You know? And Ray, that blows my mind. People that know me, we're not mixed. One of my sponsors was gay, and Ray was a retired cop. These were two people that I would not be caught dead with in the streets out there. You know? But I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't care. Why? Because God opened up my heart to everyone. It's amazing. I remember going in within my first few months, and my perception of life is changing. My sponsor tricked me again, and he goes, come on, I'm going to a convention, right? And I go there, and I realize that I'm the only straight one in the room. And I have to go up on stage, because I'm counting days in front of all the gay lesbian folks, and I didn't care. I didn't care, because I had love for my heart. God was starting to change this person. Amazing. And that right there is a total... It blows my mind how my perception is starting to change in life. And that's just from writing a fourth step and sitting down with my sponsor and doing a fifth step. And I remember when I sat down with my sponsor and did a fifth step with him, I had that deepest, darkest secret that was going to go to the grave with me. And I didn't share it the first time I did a fifth step when I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew I had to get rid of this thing, and I unloaded it on him. He didn't judge me one bit for it. You know, and I can't tell you how many fifth steps I heard since then that these guys had almost the same exact thing on there, and I could look him in the eyes and say, done that too, man. And it's alright, love you, buddy. You know? Now let's just keep moving on. Let's give it to God. You know? And I moved on, and you know, I kept going on with the rest of the steps, and I started to experience the promises in the steps, being happy, joyous, and free. Free from the obsession to drink alcohol. That was the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. Recoiled from it as if it was a hot flame. I didn't know what that was. I never experienced that for me. If I had the thought, I had the obsession, I'd went. I was rarely able to fight myself through that obsession. Right? At certain times, right? We have no mental defense against it. Certain times I was able to say, I gotta go to work tomorrow. Not very often, though. You know, and I noticed I wasn't fighting the booze, I wasn't fighting anything else. You know, I'd walk into a grocery store and I looked at the booze as if it was soda in there. I didn't say, oh my God, there's Diet Pepsi in there. I wasn't saying, oh my God, there's a 40-ounce OD in there. You know, and that's what I used to do. I used to bug out, walking into a grocery store when there was booze in there. Never mind a bar trying to go there sober, man. You know? And that obsession was lifted from me, and by God's grace, it hasn't returned for me over 7 years. And that right there alone is beyond my wildest dreams, you know? And I never thought that was possible. And I used to say, when's it coming back, man? When's it coming back? You know? Then my luck really started to change, man. I became this selfish, self-centered person who became a whole lot less selfish, self-centered. You know, I don't want to stand here to claim like I'm walking on water and I'm this great guy. I fall short, man. I have weaknesses. I'm still broken in many ways. I mean, I was a mess on Thursday night. I had something going on. I needed to call my sponsor on Friday morning, and he unloaded some stuff on me and let me know in 20 years he's got stuff going on, and we unloaded on each other. But my luck started to change, man. Even though I'm a broken person, I get to experience joy today. I get to experience peace. I get to experience camaraderie that I never thought was possible. You know, that guy that was known as Mikey No Show at work, I was able to show up at work and be a productive member, and I'm a foreman on my job today. That blows my mind. How did a guy never show up to work be a foreman? How am I responsible for the safety of the people on my job? 30 guys on the job, and I'm responsible for their safety, and I'm responsible for payroll and everything else. I mean, in the past, I would have been looking to rob everybody. Rob the company. I'm just going to hold the truck up in front of them. And I'm at my job, and I'm looking to serve, you know? And that's wild, man. And like within my first year, I'm walking on my job, walking to the job, I get off the train station, and I catch myself looking up at a church, and I'm whistling Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace. That's a far cry from this street kid in Brooklyn. It was an absolute mess. And I'm in God's grace, and I know it, and I love it, and I'm feeling it. I'm on fire, man. You know? And like, again, I don't want to paint this picture that, you know, life is all pink cloud and unicorns and rainbows and all that. I've been through some crap in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really some heartbreaking stuff, man, where I felt I was going to go out of my mind. Within my first year and a half, I used to sit on my sponsor's couch and say, all right, let me guess, who's the inventory about again, you know? It's the girl again, Jeff. He said, all right, let's hear it. And I'd share with him. And it's, I hate to sound cliche, and it's to say, what do we do? We trust God, clean house, help others, go help another drunk. And I remember times where I felt I was out of my mind, and I wanted to go back to the site one. I'm telling my sponsor, I want to go back to the site. Go to the meeting tonight and go help a drunk. And all of a sudden, my perception of life has changed. You know, it's amazing how I could be in such a bad frame of mind, right? And I'm in the house with my wife and my kids, and I'm looking at my wife. She's no good. She didn't clean the house today. My kid's crying. She won't shut up. You know, she's asking for ice cream 100 times, and I'm ready to, like, scream out, no freaking ice cream, leave me alone, right? And a drunk comes over my house, somebody that I'm sponsoring, and we go into my basement, and an hour or two later, I walk out of my basement, and I'm looking at the world through a new pair of glasses, right? And my wife is like, what happened to my husband? You know? Because what happens to somebody like me, if I don't transform that stuff, I'm going to transmit it. There's a transformation that happens there. When I'm sitting down with a drunk, and I think my life is no good, and I'm ungrateful, because I'm a chronic discontent, right? And I'm looking at my kids as if they're a problem in my life. My wife's a problem. And all of a sudden, I step off in that basement. After I'm sitting with a guy whose wife had left him, whose kids have left him, who's gotten no job, you know what I'm saying? Probably had a black eye the week before, you know? And all of a sudden, my problems become minimal, nothing. And I start to feel really foolish and self-centered, you know? And that has really saved my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really saved my life doing detox work. I don't share this like it's some resume. You know, I'm not here to share my stats. Like, I do detox work. I'm sharing because I need to do that stuff because it saved my life. And the greatest joy I got to experience ever was going into a facility, seeing somebody who was on the balls of his butt and absolutely out of his mind, and calling me when he got out of there, roll up his sleeves in Alcoholics Anonymous, watch him do the deal, help him get connected with a power greater than himself, share my experience with him, and then watch him celebrate his 1 year anniversary, and watch his family members attend and thank me for helping their husband. And having him thank me for what I've done for him. And I know it's only by God's grace, but it's an absolute privilege to be a part of that. You know, and that's what I get to experience here today in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no better experience for me than looking into the eyes of a hopeless alcoholic who's sitting across the table from me, who's saying this obsession's never going to leave me, I'm never going to get a job, my wife and kids are never going to come back, And then within a few months, there's a transformation that occurs. And it's no longer the same man. This is a guy who's now looking to go serve others the way he was served in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I pray that I can continue to do that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the name of this group, Love and Service, because I believe that it's truly my purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous to love and to serve. It's not only my purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I believe my purpose in life is to love and to serve. I believe my God wants me to love Him with all my heart, all my mind, and all my soul, to love one another. And thank God I became an alcoholic, because I would never been, ever been brought to a place where I was ever considering about loving and serving alcoholics or anybody in life. And I get to do that today. And I heard somebody tell me one time, if you haven't found love, then you haven't found God. And that's why I said tonight, I'm here to share my love story, how God, of my own understanding, took me out of the depths, deepest, darkest pits of alcoholism and brought me into the fourth dimension of existence. And again, it's only by God's grace, and it's available to every single one of us here. Thanks for letting me share.